Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stock.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Wall Street Unspun. For those of you with a good ear, you may be able to pick out that this is not Peter Schiff talking, so I have some good news and some bad news for you. This is not Peter Schiff. This is his brother, Andrew Schiff, and I work with Euro Pacific Capital out of the New York office. I've been working with Peter for years. Some of you may know me. And Peter was unable to come today. Some of you may have seen it. He was just got off the air on Kudlow and Company on CNBC. Actually, it's called CNBC Reports now, which was kind of significant. It's the first time Peter's been on the Kudlow show for about a year and a half, and we had the good fortune or lack thereof to be on with our good old friend Don Luskin, who had gone down to the mats with Peter on quite a few occasions. Some of those meetings were memorable. Anyway, it was a nice return for Peter. I think he did a good job. One thing, Don did give me a shout out. He did say that when asked to respond to a question that Peter posed to him, he said, "Well, I don't respond because I get threatening letters from Peter's brother," which is a funny inside joke, and it certainly wasn't. I didn't send him a threatening letter, but it was nice to see Peter on that show. Hopefully, he'll be on again. I think Kudlow hasn't gotten anybody like Peter on the show, so I think he needs that voice, and we think it's an important part of the financial media universe, so we hope to be there on there again. Anyway, so a weird day. Of course, they were talking about the auto bailouts, and it looks like that's going to go through. Although we're seeing a little bit of the same kind of political charade that we saw earlier with the TARP, where some of the Republicans are kind of huffing and puffing, saying they can't support it. And the Republicans had their own little press conference today. Interestingly, with the TARP, when it happened a few months ago, all that the Republicans really need to come on board is a few more $100 billion, and that convinced them. So they might huff and puff and say, we're against this. Oh, a couple more billion? Sure, we're for it. So I just find it interesting. But obviously, we're talking about the bailing out the auto industry. I mean, our belief on that system is, and we have a commentary from John Brown coming out that has some interesting comment about this. We believe that, look, these companies are just not profitable. They're not going to be profitable. $15 billion now won't make a bit of difference. They're going to be back for more. Unless you can really fundamentally address the core business issues of these companies, which, of course, the bill won't do because that would require real pain for the auto workers, that they're not going to be profitable. The whole idea of bringing in a car czar who's going to somehow hold their feet to the fire and make sure they're making the right decisions for the American people has absolutely nothing to do with profitability. I mean, I'm sure if you know anything about the way Americans like to drive, as gasoline prices are coming down, there's going to be a return of demand for big cars. That's what America wants. Now, they have to figure out how to make those things profitably, and also, well, more importantly, the American car industry needs to be able to figure out how to make cars for export, because the people outside of the United States is where the wealth is going to be. So we need to figure out how to make cars for exporting, which is, I'm sure, not what the cars are going to be having in mind. So you're going to have a centrally planned car authority who is going to try to dictate to Detroit what cars they need to make in order to be profitable. I mean, if this doesn't sound like a promising scenario, it's because it's not. And I would imagine that this will just create bigger losses. And of course, the real trouble is you got to get in with the UAW and say, look, you're getting paid so much more than your counterparts, even working for the foreign car manufacturers who do manufacture in the United States, like Toyota. You have to come down your wages. You got to be not only competitive with those people, but you got to be competitive with workers in Japan and in Germany and in places like India, where they're making cars. I mean, this is a global marketplace, and we need a vibrant manufacturing sector here. We have to compete around the world, and we have to lose our privileged status. And I just don't really see that happening. So we think this is the first in a long series of bailouts. And you know, I thought I was thinking, you know, this cars are, you know, what's next? A mortgage Maharaja or a Kaiser of credit cards? Just some thoughts I had. Anyway, so just the other big news of the day that we saw very little talk of, except for an article in the Wall Street Journal, which is a real head scratcher. And I was talking to Peter about it about an hour ago, and this is the first time I ever really saw Peter at a complete loss for understanding, and I couldn't figure it out either. But anyway, the Wall Street Journal reports that the Federal Reserve is considering for the first time issuing its own debt securities, its own bonds, like the Treasury bonds. The U.S. government issues Treasury bonds, so the Federal Reserve would issue their own bonds to compete or be an alternative form of government debt to Treasury bonds. It didn't say why they'd want to do it, and also you'd think, why would the Federal Reserve need to issue bonds? They have a printing press. They want money, they just got to print it. Peter said to me that issuing a bond is kind of like injecting money into the economy that has interest attached to it. Because when you just print money and put it out there, you're just putting out Federal Reserve notes, which of course are notes anyway. But if you put out actual bonds, then those are notes that have interest attached to them. But we still can't figure out why the Fed would need to do it. And we're interested in seeing how the story is going to be reported in the days to come, if it's reported at all. Normally we would consider it the big story of the day, but apparently it wasn't. Other just general things we're keeping our eye on. Gold had a nice day today, past $800 an ounce. I'm not sure if it closed above 800, but that's a nice move for gold. We think the gold has maintained its value fairly well. While everything else is falling, and we think, of course, gold is going to start picking up on all this inflation that's happening around the world. Speaking of global markets, for those of you who are clients, you know that the last couple of days have been pretty good for us. The dollar has retreated down to the 85 level on the dollar index, which some would indicate is they see a classic head and shoulders top forming. And for those of you who maybe not are familiar with technical landscape of stock trading, it's a shape of a graph that makes you think that a top has been put in, and that the next move is down. And basically, the dollar went up to about 85 or 86 against the dollar index, which is the broad measure of the value of the dollar, about 3 or 4 weeks ago. Then it blew up to about 89, which is the highest level we've seen in about 5 years, and wiped out all the last 4 or 5 years in decline. And then it pulled back down from 89 back to the level where it is now, about 85 again. So it's not a big move, but that could, the fact that it's trending now flat at 85 is the shoulder and the head and shoulders top. So we're thinking that, of course, it's going to move down. I mean, the move that has pushed the dollar up has been primarily driven by fear, by people selling all their assets, unwinding their leverage, piling into U.S. Treasuries. Of course, U.S. Treasuries now are having negative yields as a result of this massive move into Treasuries. So you now pay for the privilege of owning U.S. government debt. Whoopee. But we see this as kind of unwinding, and as the true value of some of these foreign stocks become evident in terms of 2 and 3 times multiples on the P.E. ratios and 20 and 30% dividend yields, as these fundamentals reassert themselves, and the fact that a lot of these companies are coming out with earnings reports that are pretty good. Again, I mean, one of the things that separates the United States from the rest of the world is that, you know, when credit, consumer credit's a big problem here, that's a big problem because we do everything on credit. But in other countries, some Australia excluded perhaps, but in other countries, they rely much less on consumer credit. They actually pay for things in cash. So a credit crisis doesn't really affect their economy to nearly the extent that it does for ours. Anyway, so moving around the world, Rio Tinto, one of the largest mining companies in the world, was up 20% today, and that kind of caused a whole rally in the mining sector because they were cutting jobs, and they presented a plan towards profitability, and they're going to maintain their dividend, which is a nice thing to do. Cutting jobs, retrenching, it showed that the market had a lot of confidence in the move, and they were up 20%, and a lot of other companies went with them. Similarly, for job cutting, Office Depot in the United States announced they're going to close 112 stores and cut 2,000 jobs. That should be a very sure sign of the recession here is really taking hold and is spreading throughout the country and will be with us for some time to come. Oil is starting to stabilize, perhaps moved up a little bit today. We don't know if the bottom's in for oil. It certainly could drift down. The inventory numbers are still showing a lot of inventory out there. Obviously, when you see gold, oil come back from 140 to 40, there's a lot of speculation. There's a lot of sentiment that's feeding into the oil market. We don't know where the price really should. Obviously, we think the price should be higher. There is still strong demand for oil around the world. The rally in the dollar has certainly been a big part of the fall in oil. We think oil is going to go back up. Where the bottom is, I don't know, but it's nice to see some signs of stabilization. And the last thing that I'll mention as the news of the day is Las Vegas announced that gambling revenue has fallen 26% for the 10th quarter in a row. Gambling revenue is falling, and you're right. I heard that 4 or 5 years ago, people used to say that gambling, one of the sin stocks, tobacco, gambling, those are non-cyclical. They'll always do well. People are always going to want to, in good times and bad, drown their sorrows in alcohol. Or a weekend in Vegas and gets people to forget about their troubles. Well, apparently that old maxim is not holding through. Las Vegas is hurting. Of course, that's not even mentioning the real estate market in Las Vegas, which is completely imploded. But the one last thing I'll mention is an interesting story. It's kind of hard to keep your head above it. What's going on with GMAC, which is of course GM's auto finance unit. Well, all the attention is focused on the big three and the auto bailouts. The acceptance corps, GMAC, which is the company that essentially loans money to Americans to buy GM cars and also has a mortgage unit and has been one of the only profitable areas of GM for the past couple of years, last year excluded, is in a situation where they try to become a bank. Basically, in order to get access to the TARP money, they had to declare themselves a bank holding company, which was an interesting move. But their current that would have rewritten the terms of their current bonds in a way that would have really punished their existing bondholders. And the existing bondholders were threatening, were resisting. They needed to get the approval of the bondholders to change the designation of their firm. And the bondholders weren't really playing ball; they were expressing some reluctance. And basically, GMAC said, "Look, if you guys don't play ball with us, if you don't vote for this, we're going to withdraw our application to become a bank." And the implication was, if we do that, we'll go bankrupt. So it's just an interesting little game of chicken they're playing with their bondholders. But I think it's, of course, emblematic of what's going on and shows the true weakness of the economy across all sectors. I mean, it's just a matter of time before these same kind of situations start arriving in the credit card companies, the American Expresses, and the Discovery Financials of the world. So that's it. I'm not going to monologue that Peter usually launches on a half-hour monologue before takes a call. I don't think I have that verbal stamina in me, so I'll go right to the phones. And let's go with Jeff from Indiana. Are you still there?
I'm here.
Okay, Jeff, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Hey, listen, I just have I have a real quick question in two parts. Just kind of breaking down the bailout packages that are on the table already. From what I gathered, we have about $8.5 trillion in total, half of which is in the form of loans with a threat of an additional $10 billion for AIG possibly,
and then
$15 billion for the automakers.
Yeah, well, today's package was $15 billion.
Okay.
Okay.
But none of this money has actually been injected directly to consumers, of which 70% of the consumption component of GDP is coming from consumer spending. Now,
right.
My first question, given that, is where, I want to reiterate to myself and also the listeners, where is the real threat of inflation coming from bailout money? Given that what I just gave you.
Well, this is a big question right now, and Peter kind of almost got into it today on CNBC. But people say, well, where's the inflation? And now it's our feeling that they're injecting all this money into the system. Now it's not there yet because they're giving it to the banks, and the banks are using it to prepare their own balance sheets and kind of you know, fix, plug their own holes. Of course, the politicians aren't happy about that because they're not turning around and lending the money, because of course lending would be a terrible business decision from their perspective. But the politicians don't care about that. But the money is there; it just hasn't really gotten out into the consumers' hands. But they're throwing all this money into the system. They're increasing the money supply at a torrid clip. So people say, well, if you're right, Peter, or in this case, Andrew, well, where's the inflation? It's not showing up in the CPI. And inflation in CPI has been, the last couple of months at least, has been low. And here's the explanation. I mean, we are in the midst of a recession and a collapsing bubbles in real estate and stocks, and we're seeing significant reversals in the price of commodities based upon slowing growth. So prices are coming down because there's less demand. You know, so prices are a function of supply and demand. And prices are, through the natural courses of supply and demand, coming down because demand is ebbing and economic activity is ebbing. But at the same time, inflation or increasing money supply is an inflationary stimulus because it increases the amount of money in circulation and allows people to bid up prices. So
right.
There's a tension between those two forces. Now, right now, since a lot of that money hasn't gotten into the marketplace yet, and there is demand being pushed down by the recession, right now deflation's got the whip hand, and that's what's driving prices right now.
Okay, but now that kind of leads into the second part.
Let me just finish this one little thing. That's a temporary factor. You know, once those factors are gone, all that money is going to stay there. And when supply of goods contracts, then you've got more money, you've got lesser supply of goods, and you can do the math. Now, go ahead.
Right, and that would be the definition of hyperinflation. But now, in the face of, you know, you mentioned deflationary risk in the short term, maybe out over the next, you know, 9 to 12 months. This second part of the question has more to do with the velocity of money. How long will it take, in your opinion, for these bailout funds to actually, you know, reach the, you know, the grassroots of the economy?
Well, I don't know. I mean, and people, we're constantly asked to put a time frame on things, and it's always very difficult. And you know, the velocity of money has always been one of those economic metrics that I've always had a problem with. But I don't know. I mean, obviously, the problem is they want, and the thing is, the government's going to figure out, or try to figure out, ways to completely, put the money directly in people's hands. And because they're getting frustrated with the fact that the banks aren't lending, because the banks shouldn't be lending. And that's any sensible person who owns a bank doesn't want to lend,
right?
You know, because you have shareholders to protect. Because you don't want to be stupid. And Americans are already too over leveraged, so of course you're not going to lend. The government's going to give you money. Fantastic, I can use it for a lot of things. I don't want to lend it. So the government's going to do a lot of things, either mandate the banks or they're going to figure out some ways to get the money directly into consumers' hands, which would obviously be more inflationary. But in terms of when the money already out there enters the system and when it's going to create inflation, I don't know. I don't know. We just know. I mean, people asked us, asked Peter, you know, when are these tech stocks going to go down? They're going up every day. We don't know. It's going to happen. We don't know when the hyperinflation really gains traction, and more importantly, where it overpowers the deflationary forces that are in the economy right now, and there are. When that happens, I can't tell you. We just prepare for that day.
Okay.
Okay.
That was my question in its entirety. Thank you so much.
No problem. Okay, let's go to Claude from Connecticut. Are you still there, Claude?
Yes. Hi. How
are
you doing,
Claude? What part of Connecticut are you from?
I'm from near Waterbury.
Near Waterbury, sure. Actually, I spent a lot of time up in Litchfield County, and Peter and I were both born in New Haven, Connecticut, if you don't.
Yeah, so was I.
I know that. Excuse me?
So was I.
All right, go New Haven. Nice little town. If you ever, great pizza in New Haven. If anyone's driving past New Haven, make sure you go to Worcester Street, either Sally's or Pepe's, great pizza.
Right.
Anyway, what's your question, Claude?
I have only one question and a couple thoughts here, but I think that it's a good one. Do you think that the Chinese understand that letting the American dollar go down will work in their favor? Or because, like, our government doesn't seem to understand the implications of what this, you know, having that happen, letting that happen, the implications of it. Or do you think the Chinese don't fully understand what could happen that will be in their favor? Or are they going to be forced into it?
That's an excellent question, a question that we've struggled with for years. We don't know the answer to that. I mean, it seems like a very simple thing. You know, you have a billion people who are working hard, who don't have a lot of material possessions, that have a lot of savings. The demand there is kind of not that stimulated because they don't have a lot of purchasing power. You would seem that it would be a great thing if those Chinese people, if the yuan were worth 2-3 times what it's worth now, which it easily could be if market forces were brought to bear, then look at how much more much more consumption those Chinese could do. Look how much better their lives could be. How many more appliances and goods they can afford. How they can compete around the world for goods and services that they can't afford right now.
Yeah, I think the biggest factor right now with the American dollar is what the Chinese do with their treasury bills, treasury bills. And, if they decide to sell them off a little at a time, that will have an impact.
Oh, of course. I mean, the Chinese announced a few weeks ago, their own $600 billion stimulus plan, which, we're not really over, as free marketeers, we're not really being in favor of government-directed stimuli, but hell, they've got the money. They've got $1.5 trillion of foreign reserves. They could spare the $600 billion. They have it in their sock drawer.
The way I understand it to work is that if we have inflation in our country, because they are pegging to our dollar, they're going to be forced to readjust their currencies
yes, yes.
to meet ours. And
yes,
when
that's what I was getting.
They may be unwilling.
If they're going to maintain, and for whatever reason they want, they've decided to maintain the peg, give or take 20%. They've allowed it to appreciate slowly. My theory is that the Chinese are completely committed to status quo. They don't want to see any rapid changes in their economy. They don't want to see any rapid retooling or any rapid adjustment from an export-based economy to a domestic sales-based economy, because they don't want the disruption. They don't want anybody to lose jobs. They're very nervous about their political stability there, because they're not a democracy, and they've seen what happened in Tiananmen, and they want to keep things on a very even keel. So if they're in an export-driven economy, they want to change very, very, very slowly. That's the only thing I can see. Now, getting back to your point, if we're floating trillions of dollars of new debt, and we are, I mean, the U.S. government, we're going to see a $1 trillion deficit in 2009, $2 trillion in 2010. Who knows? But we're forcing those, since we can't buy our own treasury bills, we are forcing the world, primarily the Chinese, to continue to buy our debt. So they might have $1.8 trillion now or $1.5 trillion now. We're saying, hey, Chinese, get ready. It's going to be $3 trillion after a while, and you're going to continue to buy it if you want to maintain the status quo. So we're really putting them in a hard spot, especially when they want to spend their own money for their own stimulus. Now they're going to finance their own stimulus and our stimulus. So, at some point, they have to, stop throwing good money after bad. Now, if they start selling, will that cause a run on the dollar? You better believe it. But but when it comes to that, it's not so much the Chinese. You got to watch the smaller players. I mean, there's a lot of countries out there with hundreds of billions of dollars of dollar reserves, and maybe Thailand decides that they want to be the first guy out, and they want to get rid of their dollars while the going's good. It won't take much between for one bank to start selling, and then everyone else heads for the exits. It's not just the Chinese.
My feeling is that, because I've been listening to everything, just about as much information I can get about how, Peter looks at all this stuff from Europac, but my feeling is that at some point they're going to be forced into it, because what they're dealing with is market forces. And the bailout money that our government is putting in is money that is missing because we can't pay. Our government is being forced to put money back into the system because that money's missing. And somehow,
Where are they getting it from?
Right, it's they're printing it.
Right. Well, they have two ways. They can print the money, but again, they print the money. But mostly, the printed money, meaning they create treasury bills, and treasury bills are bought by the Fed or sold overseas, which is primarily how it happens.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's okay. What I'm saying is our government is being forced into this because we can't pay. So they're printing money and putting it back into the economy to make up for what is missing. Now, my feeling is at some point the Chinese are going to be forced more or less to do the same type of thing. They're going to be forced into it because of the market forces.
Well, when you have the kind of money the Chinese do, it's hard. You have the ability of not being forced, because you can make decisions you have the benefit of wealth. So it's kind of hard to predict what they might do. I do have a feeling based upon, you know, how the Chinese government reacts, they don't do anything they don't want to do. You know, they're very deliberative, and they're very. I think that in a lot of ways they're very archaic. You know, they're still steeped in the kind of the one party system, the Communist Party rule. At least not in the economic theory, but in terms of the political control and the top down decision making, they are. Okay. Anyway, let's go to the next call. We've got thanks Claude, John from Oklahoma. Are you still there? That's a negative. Dave from Toronto. Is this Dave from Toronto?
Good stuff. Thanks for taking my call.
No problem, Dave. How's it going up there in Canada?
You know, it's not too bad, but things are getting slow, and I think we're following in the same direction as you guys. I don't think
okay.
any different. But my question is, it's similar to the other questions you've received, unfortunately, but when I think of just the situation with China and the United States, and I think of North America in a similar situation, but... I feel like China isn't ready to make this transition. And I think that if they were to make this transition, then, and also if the United States is going to fall, like you're predicting, and like, I agree, it should happen. It makes sense. But, would the United States not have to pull out of Iraq and the Middle East? And would that not create some like instability in the world? And also I'm thinking, I'm thinking everybody's investing in the United States right now in the Treasury bills simply because you have the military power to defend what you know.
That's what I've heard. You know, I've heard people talk about how the military might give the makes the impression of financial stability. I find that to be kind of an interesting concept. But yes, clearly, I mean, obviously, as we get poorer as a nation, and well, you'd say the first part of the question is, you can't see China doing it, and you know, I mean that's the whole point. I mean Peter, sooner or later, I mean the whole point of an economy is not to work or have a job. People say, oh, we're sending all the jobs to China. You know, having a job is no great deal. I mean, it's the spending part, it's the money part that you want. You, no one wants to work. I mean, some people have very interesting jobs, and they really really like it. But primarily, most people work because they need to live, and they need the money, and they need to buy things. So the working part is not the great part. It's the spending part. In fact, you know, it's very easy to have a job and not pay somebody for it. It's called slavery. And, you know, fortunately, we don't have that anymore. But the Chinese have been working, but they haven't really been buying. Now, I don't know much about human beings. I mean, I've never really been to China, but I know something about human beings. And human beings, by and large, are motivated by not working and having leisure. And buying things and eating better and you know, and having relaxation and having a nice house. And that's what people, traveling a little bit, that's what people like to do. And I think the Chinese like to do it too. Of course, you know, 50 years ago, of course, they were on a 17th century economy. They were completely subsistence level. Now they've made huge strides, but they're still working. I mean, these people are working, you know, 12 hours a day. They have, the health care is abominable. There's no national education to speak of. They got to pay for their education up front in cash. And, you know, wouldn't they want a lifestyle? I mean, not saying to be Americans culturally. I'm not trying to, you know, say there's something better about American culture that everyone should want in terms of, you know, who we are as a people. But, I mean, wouldn't they want to have more, a refrigerator? Maybe some air conditioning, maybe a little car instead of a bicycle. You know, wouldn't they like to travel even within their own country? And you know, maybe not on top of the train, but you know, maybe they would want to have more comfort. And you know, so I think that they want to get there, and they're certainly amassing. And that's what happened in the United States. In the United States, we became rich in the 19th century because we were the most profitable country in the world. I mean, we produced for ourselves and we exported stuff. And we, in the 19th century, anything mass-produced, primarily, not everything, but because, of course, the English and the Germans did it as well, but a lot of mass-produced consumer goods were made here. And we exported them around the world. And when we were doing that, Americans had very high comparative wages. We were paying the highest wages in the world. And we still managed to manufacture cheap goods that were competitive overseas. That's because we were the center of innovation. We were the center of an industrial revolution. That's the same thing that's going on in China right now. I mean, they're the low-cost producer, but this, and they have the biggest factories, they're the most efficient, but their people are not enjoying the benefits. And that's because the Chinese are riding herd over their monetary policy. Because if the renminbi were allowed to rise, you know, let's say it would be double or triple in value. Now we wouldn't have the trade deficit we had with China because we couldn't afford to buy as many. If the renminbi were three times higher, we couldn't afford to buy as much stuff from China as we could before. You know, we couldn't buy, you know, $2 packages of 12 tube socks at Walmart because they wouldn't be $2. They'd be $10, and we'd buy fewer tube socks from China. And they'd be able to buy more from us because they'd be richer, and they'd be able to outbid other people for American goods, assuming they wanted American goods. So just by having a higher, the currency movement would eliminate the trade deficit. And of course, then the Chinese citizens would be able to buy, you know, more stuff that the Chinese factories made. I mean, right now what they're doing is they're taking precious land, labor and capital, you know, employing people, buying raw materials to make stuff to send to us. Now, what benefit did they get from that? You know, I was in Walmart, and I live in Brooklyn, New York, and this is about a year ago, and I was looking at all these enormous backyard barbecues that they were selling. They were basically the size of Volkswagens, these things. They had, you know, gas and sinks and refrigerators. And these are backyard barbecues. Now, first of all, in Brooklyn, we don't have very big backyards. They're pretty small. And, you know, and they're all made in China. And I was thinking to myself, do the workers who are making these things, do they even know what they are? I bet you they think they're making kitchens that get put into houses. These backyard barbecues are probably way advanced in terms of the kitchen equipment than the workers had in their own kitchens. They probably didn't even realize what they were making. And why would they, you know, and what's the demand for backyard barbecues in China? Probably non-existent. So they're taking all of this metal and equipment to make something that they don't even want. That for Americans really don't even need, because I mean, if you live in Brooklyn, you don't need a backyard barbecue. I can tell you that from experience. Maybe a Weber, you know, but that's about it. So, you know, wouldn't that material have been better used making a consumer good or a refrigerator that the Chinese would want to buy that was specifically manufactured for the Chinese market? We think that would be the Chinese would be better off because they would have a better standard of living. They would enjoy the fruits of their labor, and instead of working to satisfy the needs or the wild extravagance of Americans. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it makes total sense. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, it does make total sense. But then you say, well, you're looking at these are smart people who are in charge of China. Why don't they do it that way? If it's so easy, why don't they do it that way?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, and one other thing, I mean, the people that are in charge of China and the elites of China, maybe, you know what, maybe this revolution that should take place, maybe it's not really going to benefit them as much, and maybe, you know, the average person in China isn't really aware of, you know, to the extent that...
I'm sure that's the case, too, because, I mean, either you know, I mean, they have a lot of restrictions in China in terms of news content, and things are very heavily monitored. They have a lot of propaganda. And you're not talking about people who are, I mean, I don't want to be, you know, sound, you know, chauvinistic about it, but I'm sure that the people in China don't have, they're barely newly arrived to the modern world with communications. They're probably not as wise as in the ways of capital of the world as probably a lot of other citizens around the country, around the world, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you never know. Anyway, thanks for your call, Dave. People out there, you know, we do have some lines open, so feel free to call. We're here for another 25 minutes. Love to hear your calls. But for now, I'll go from Doug from Pennsylvania. Doug, are you there?
Hi, Andrew. I'm here.
Okay, good. What part of Pennsylvania are you from?
Near Philadelphia, the city of brotherly love.
Yes, I like Philly. It's a nice town. Love the food, love the atmosphere. Love the architecture, and only 90 miles from New York City. What's on your mind, Doug?
Well, I have a couple questions. I'm a big fan of LouRockwell.com. You know, Jim Rogers. These guys are all talking about getting out of the dollar. You know, liquidate your funds, so to speak. Well, I mean, most people have probably a majority of their funds in their 401k plans. Myself, I'm a late financial bloomer. I'll put it that way. And you know, I own a home. I've we recently rented that out and downscaled myself, so I'm renting, so I'm taking a revenue from renting my primary property simply just because it could not sell. But I recently opened an account at EuroPac, and I'm going through filling out the paperwork and so forth. But my main question is, they're talking about getting out of the dollar. My 401k, like everyone else's, is starting to take a hit, starting to look like it's going to evaporate.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm looking for, the main answer is it a good time, really, to take the penalty up front, liquidate the 401k, move the funds into, you know, foreign investments, metals, you know, commodities, so forth, mainly because I have a time horizon of 25 to 30 years.
Right.
So, I mean, it's okay. Why not just take the hit now and let the money...
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if you have to take a hit to liquidate the 401k and roll it over into an IRA. I should know that, but I don't. I think you might, you know, obviously you can't move an IRA intact, that's wedded to the company, but whether or not I would ask your benefits officer, can you transfer any of the money out without taking a tax hit? That being said, if you can't, and if the company you're working with doesn't offer anything in the way of a real diversified investment option. Obviously, we try to be, you know, internationally focused, and they might offer an international fund, a mutual fund or two. Then you got to look at those funds, because a lot of those international, you know, funds are about as, you know, we said the metaphor we used to use is they're about as exotic or as authentically foreign as an Italian dinner at the Olive Garden. Maybe everyone loves the Olive Garden. I don't know, but a lot of those mutual funds are really they specialize in these very large multinationals that are very well interconnected with the U.S. economy that really aren't foreign. So we have a hard time with those. But some of them might be better. I mean, some of these, there are a lot of great foreign international funds. The question is whether or not your 401k plans offers them. So I would take a good look at what the offerings are. And if there's nothing, if they just offer you U.S. funds and that's it, and it's all dollars. And you got to do, you ask yourself a gut check. You say, if it's not a lot of money and you want to get out of it and you have to pay a penalty, you might consider that. You would liquidate it. You take the tax hit, and you could take the thing. Good thing is you could use that money to open up an IRA, and then you'd have a deduction from the. You could take that and open an IRA, and then you'd have the maximum deduction. I think for a year is like $8,000. You can deduct that from your taxes. So. You'd have that going for you. I mean, I don't know if you can do the whole thing, but then the next year you can make a similar deduction, donation to your IRA, and then we can take that money and do whatever we want to do with it. Whatever you want to do with it, but of course we can get it to you in commodities outside the dollar. And speaking of, I mean, look, I'm sure people listening there know, and we certainly haven't hidden from this fact, is that, you know, our portfolios have suffered pretty significantly over the past 8 or 10 months. And primarily, that's been a factor of two things. Global stock markets have sold off, commensurate with the sell-off in the U.S. stock market. I think, you know, saying a little bit more and depending on the country. But you've also got to factor in the incredible rise the dollar's had in the past 8-9 months. I mean, the dollar's rallied 30% against a lot of currencies. So, you know, a lot of the stocks that we picked are generally on the more conservative end of the spectrum in terms of stocks. We don't do a lot of, you know, stocks like in electronics or, you know, startup types of things. So we tend to look at the value stocks. So I think a lot of the stocks we've chosen haven't gone down as much as a lot of other stocks in those markets. But when you factor in the currency movements, you know, our portfolios are down significantly for those who invested this year. That being said, we have seen a nice stabilization in the last couple of weeks, some significant bounces in some of the stocks. I mean, the gold mining stocks, the energy stocks, the coal stocks in particular, some of the REITs out in Asia have bounced very nicely. And for those of them, people lucky to get in on the right day, they've seen good, very significant upside. Of course, people in general have seen a stabilization and a general upturn over the last 3 weeks. And a lot of that is the dollar isn't. I mean, I don't know whether the dollar is falling now. And it's put this reversal in, but I will say that it's not rising now. It isn't rising, and it might, at least right now. And the case you've got to make, the intellectual case you've got to make to say the dollar is going to rise from here, it's a tough one. It's a long argument. A lot of it's based on illogic. A lot of it's based on faith. There's not a lot of fundamentals there. But to make the argument the dollar is going to fall from here, that's a pretty easy argument to make. So we think the timing is good now. You know, it's always easy to say that, but I mean, when you look around and look at some of the indicators, I particularly am pretty confident. Anyways, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does, and perhaps okay. Answer one more. Short question. Recently, okay. I've taken nearly 10,000 invested in physical metals, but I'm also looking to diversify into foreign currencies. But my main question there is, how does one get actually in their hand euros? I mean, I'm going to
you want bills in your hand?
Yeah, exactly. Like,
There's not. I don't really see there's much use for that. I mean, there's if you want to own euros and you want to own them cheaply and you want to own euros, there's ways to do that through various products online. You can trade like stocks. They're very easy and very liquid, and we could buy them for you, or your online brokerage can buy them for you. They trade in the New York Stock Exchange. They're currency shares. They're very liquid. They're easy to buy. I mean, if you just want to own euros, now the question is you're not actually owning a physical piece of paper in your hand, and some people are nervous about that. You say, what happens if the stock market stops functioning? Then I can't get my money out. You know, that's an issue. Personally, I don't think that's an issue that's a real issue or a likely issue. But if you do want actual euros, I don't know ways to get them. You can obviously go to Europe. That's one way, and it's very enjoyable. Europe's a great place if you've never been there. You can go to Europe, and I think there might be limits on how much euros you can take out, but you can figure out what that limit might be. Other than that, I'm sure there's ways to buy them here, and you could probably pay a premium for them, and someone will sell you euros or whatever kind of currency you want, but I don't know how to do that. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, thanks a lot. Let's go to David from California.
Taking my call.
Yeah, thank you. You've been hanging out for a while there, so I appreciate that.
No, that's fine. I'm glad to talk to you.
No problem. What part of California are you from?
I'm from the Bay Area.
The Bay Area. Peter, did you see Peter? He was just there a couple weeks ago.
No, I didn't, but I did hear that he was at the Hard Asset Conference.
Yeah, he was.
I didn't know he was out here, but I didn't get a chance
to actually hear. He sent out an email. It was their conference, and they were very happy to have Peter, and they were very happy to work with us. We asked him if we could use one of their rooms to do a conference. He was supposed to be on one panel, and they said, sure, you can have a room. We sent out one email, and we had 900 people that showed up, which is amazing in terms of the turnout. So he did that. You know, Peter went to school in Berkeley, if you knew that or not, and
yep.
He lived in California at that point. So anyway, what's your question?
I was wondering which three stock markets in the world do you think are the most attractive right now for investment?
Good question.
Not for trade.
And, you know, it's kind of hard to pick a winner. Although, you know, we're working on a commentary right now where we said clearly, you know, in 2009, the gold, silver, and bronze investment metals go to U.S. Treasuries. So they're the only asset class that did well in 2008. But what are the top three overseas? I mean, obviously, you know, the markets that we invest in primarily, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, Japan, Switzerland, Northern Europe. I'll say this: we've been playing around with some Indonesian stocks recently. Not playing around. There are a few Indonesian stocks that are in our recommended list, and they've been doing very well. It's kind of an overlooked market that I think is got some good fundamentals and it's got some good companies. Peter really likes Singapore. Singapore is in a very strategic place around the world. It's sitting as it is on the Straits of Malacca, on the hub of trade between the Pacific and the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. Very stable company, very honest government, very transparent capital markets. Peter's always liked Singapore. I'm sure he'd put that in the list. Australia, New Zealand, clearly that those kind of countries have some fundamental problems with consumer debt. They had real estate bubbles similar to ours. But when you look at their economies and the fact that they run very large trade surpluses and they're commodity-based economies, they sell into the manufacturing zones in Asia. You have to think that they're well positioned. Their currencies, meanwhile, have sold off tremendously. I mean, the Aussie dollar is down about 25 or 30 percent and we think that's gonna come back. So for those reasons, you can get very, we trust those countries. We think they're going to do the right thing. There's an election in New Zealand, for instance. The Conservatives came in, which is kind of counter trend, but we take confidence from that. So I really couldn't say what my top three are. I would defer to Peter on that one. But we do think that there's the sell off in currency, which is really the important part. I mean, it's very hard to have a crystal ball in the investment world, but you do want to be on the side of the huge macro trend. And when you see the rally the dollar's had in the last few months, you know that can't be sustained. Just getting up into any stable market that you think you have confidence in that has a viable economy without selling into U.S. consumers, then that's a good place to be. Okay?
Okay. And could you comment a little bit on the Federal Reserve's plan to issue its own debt instruments?
Yeah, I mentioned that at the top of the show. I actually led off with that. I led off with the auto bailout. Yeah, that was a big head-scratcher. I was talking to Peter about that for about 10 minutes, about 2 hours ago, and I was troubled. What is that? Why would they want to do that? Why would the Federal Reserve... They have printing presses. They can print as much money as they want. Why would they need to issue Federal Reserve bonds? And why would you want to have a... Why would you want to... you have a Treasury Department to do that. Why would you want to compete? And these things, of course, would compete. I don't know how they would be any different from Treasury bonds. They come with a more attractive, coupon. Who knows? I mean, better artwork. And since they have a printing press, why would they need to do it? And Peter's idea was the only thing that he thought, the only advantage that this has over a printing press is that you can print money and you put it out into the system and it's just money. But if you print a bond and put it out into the system, it's money that earns interest. So it earns interest for the people who buy it. So it's even better than money. It's money with benefits.
It received very little coverage in the media today, other than in the Wall Street.
Very, very little. In fact, I was waiting for the coverage. It was a Wall Street Journal story that I saw this morning, and I thought I'd come in and see, like, everyone, millions of other stories saying, what's this all about? Because the story that the Journal story didn't have a lot of details, and it didn't have a lot of analysis. And I'm like, okay, where's the analysis? And it never came. And, I think it's just, I don't know, people were really focused on the auto bailouts. But I'm going to look for that tomorrow. I'm looking for the answers in terms of why they're doing that, and we don't know.
And I know you're very bearish on the dollar, but don't you think that other governments will take measures just like the Federal Reserve is, or other central banks rather will take measures just as the Federal Reserve is doing
and,
now?
And they are, which is why not as radically as ours, which is why all currencies will depreciate. Ours will depreciate faster, which is why you need to own some gold in your portfolio.
Okay.
We got to move on because I'm running out of time. Let's go to Justin from Colorado. Well, I didn't get that call just in time. Sorry about that, folks. A little Justin joke. Justin, you're not there. I'm going to go to the next caller, but I will say that we got about 10 more minutes left. So after I take this call, there should be another slot for another caller. So if you do have a question, give me a call. I should have a chance to take your call because I've only got one more caller on the line here. So let's go with John from Virginia.
Hello there. How are you this evening?
How you doing, John?
Doing great. Hey, I appreciate you taking my call.
No problem.
The previous caller sort of touched on the subject. I too have a 401k that has as the only non-U.S. asset is the Morgan Stanley Europe Far East Australasia Index, and it basically just tracks that.
That's the MSCI, EFA index.
Correct.
Okay.
I just wondered what your general thoughts were, but I heard what you said as far as it's as authentic as an Italian dinner at the
Olive Garden.
Same time, when it's the only option that I have, I'm wondering.
Well, that the MSCI EFA index is the broadest index that exists for the global stocks, and that's really the best. It tries to take out America from the equation. So if that's your only option, then yeah, it's a decent option. I mean, the thing is, what you're getting is you're getting the broadest possible exposure. Of course, that's going to mean that. It's weighted as the markets are weighted. So the biggest companies are going to have the biggest impact on the performance of the index.
Right.
So
70% Europe, if I remember correctly, on the...
Is it 70%
Europe? 70%
Europe
and 30% Far East and Australasia. You know, very small percentages. And I, again, if I should have called it up on the computer, I could have given you the breakdown. But I know that the 70% of the index is European, and that's a broad, and that's you know, skewed countries as well.
Well, yeah, our portfolios that we design for people are generally about 30% Europe, so that weighting is significantly different.
I gotcha. Okay.
You know, and the kind of stocks we're going to get here are going to be very different it's going to perform very different from the MSCI EAFE index, because we're going to favor much smaller companies. The average company, we don't really invest with too many companies north of $10 billion in market cap.
Right, so they're...
Most of the companies that we are in that $1 to $10 billion range. And that's because we tend to focus like companies that, first of all, that don't trade in America, that don't have U.S. listings, that are going to be only listed in foreign exchanges. That's where we think we provide some, you know, some good advantage. And we think those companies have better valuations, that they have more they sell primarily to themselves, they're more insulated from the U.S. economy. They have lower multiples and higher yields. So we're going to have a different general overall weighting than that. We're going to have a higher concentration of much smaller companies and companies that pay higher dividends. I mean, we gravitate towards the dividend stocks. I mean, that's what we do.
I'm so concerned about it. Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You know, and so that's different. I mean, if that's all that you've got, I mean, you know, people here, by the way, even if you're not clients and you want to just talk to somebody, you know, most brokers here would be more than happy to take a call from anybody, say, look, I've got these options. I can't get out of them. This is my 401k. What would you do?
You know, I tried that. I spoke to one of the gentlemen up there named Andy, by the way. I don't think it was you.
Andy Chon in Los Angeles?
I didn't get his last name, but yeah. I told him, you know, I said that the this index was my only option, and he was hesitant to give me any advice one way or the other. I think I got the gist of it, though. And you know, reading Crash Proof, which I got to tell you, until 2.5 weeks ago, and I stumbled on, you know, Peter Schiff was right, 2006 to 2008, like the rest of America did. I was unaware of most of all of it. So I appreciate first and foremost.
No problem.
As they're doing, getting the information out there. I just wish more people would pay attention.
Okay, we're trying. We're trying. And Peter, we're getting, you know, believe me, I do the media for the firm. I work with all the television people. I work with all the print people. I've been working with Peter first, not necessarily as an employee, because I was a consultant before, but I've been working with Peter for about 6 years. And I'm acutely aware of the level of interest and the degree of seriousness in which the rest of the media takes Peter. And it's starting to snowball. It's getting big. And that YouTube video, which we didn't even do, which someone else did, we kind of gave it a push once it was out there, has made a huge impact. And it's really shown us a lot about what, you know, the viral media and what it can do in the world today. Anyway, so let me go on. Let's go. We've got two more callers here. We've got John from Virginia. Thanks a lot, Mike. John from Virginia. Go ahead. And Justin called back. We'll get to Justin in a second. John, how's it going?
Justin. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, I just had a question. I've heard so much these days this debate between the inflation and deflation, and I guess I'm just curious if you could see a situation where the sort of inflation from credit might actually be replaced by sort of dollar inflation, if that makes sense.
Well, I mean, in credit is a way for, you know, dollars to get into the into the money supply. I mean, it used to be that, you know, in order for someone to lend some a dollar, someone had to save a dollar, so there was a zero sum game there. But now, of course, you have fractional reserve banking, and you have the ability of credit to create money. You know, credit is contracting as it should be, so that's taking money out of the system or at least slowing it down, I think. But again, there's going to be different. The government's going to be working in different ways to figure out how to get money into people's hands. I don't know if you were listening to earlier in the show, I mean, we do have this, people are saying, okay, well, the money's expanding now, supply is expanding now, and the government's, you know, putting out hundreds of billions and trillions of dollars into the economy, and you guys say it's going to be inflationary. Well, where's the inflation? And we're saying, look, it's going to be there. What we're seeing right now is we're heading into a serious recession, a Category 5 recession, and recessions are, by definition, deflationary.
Yeah.
You know, because the demand goes down. Now, recessions are, by definition, deflationary, but it doesn't mean that there has to be deflation. Because if the deflationary pressures of a recession are overwhelmed by the inflationary forces of an expanding money supply than you have inflation during a recession, which is what we had in the 1970s. And they had a name for it, if you recall.
Stagflation.
Stagflation. I was around in the 70s. I was mostly interested in my toys, but I was around, and I did watch the news occasionally, and I remember that word, stagflation. So we had that, and we think we're going to have that. But right now, for a variety of reasons, that money that we've put into the economy hasn't gotten there yet and hasn't overwhelmed the deflationary forces. So we're kind of in this thing going back and forth.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm curious as far as asset prices, if you think that, you know, say Obama does, they throw around these numbers of $900 billion stimulus, something like that. I mean, what kind of effect do you think that would have?
Short term, I mean, the stimulus is not going to help, because what are they going to do? I mean, even the infrastructure, you know, he's going to employ people to build roads, okay, or build, you know, that might help. I mean, that's the kind of thing you want to do when you have a lot of money, and you've got to. That's what we did in the 50s. We had, you know, we had some money laying around, so we're do something with it. I mean, but once the road is built, you know, okay, it makes things a little bit more efficient, but does it really change the equation?
Yeah.
You know, now you're going to keep on employing that person, or now the road's finished, you're going to fire that person. Uh-oh, we're in the same position we're in. Unless you can build, the whole point is not to build, when you build a factory, the whole point is not to build a factory, and good, we built a factory, and look at all the money we spent building the factory. Is you build an asset that actually produces something, that makes a return, that's an investment in the future. Unless these jobs really do that, they don't help, they just delay.
Yeah.
Anyway, let me take Justin's call, because he's been hanging on for it, he called back. I've only got a few minutes left, so... Thanks for the call, John. And I want to get this last call. Justin,
that was
Colorado. You're on.
Thanks.
Hey, Justin, you there?
It's still me.
It's still John.
Oh.
Are you Justin?
This is Justin. Yeah, sorry.
I've been talking to you for a while.
Yep.
Okay. Sorry about that. Oops. So okay, I didn't mean to hustle you off there. Now, do you have any more questions, or did I answer all?
Oh, I think that's about it. It's a pretty exciting time. Every day there's a new head scratching article out there.
It used to be, you know, you'd have a story of the week. Now you have four stories of the day.
Yeah,
and we try to stay on top of it. And you know, it used to be, I've been doing this for Peter for a long time. It used to be, you know, we'd pick out a story that was worth commenting on, and you know, Peter would come and talk to me about, you know, this story happened, or these are just kind of breaking stories that would happen in the news cycle on a daily basis. Let's comment on this, or let's comment on that, and we'd put together a statement and we'd send it out, and the press would pick up on it or not, typically not, but they would pick up on a lot. Now, we could send out, you know, we stopped doing it. We could send out literally five statements a day on a variety of stories that are comment worthy. That we don't do, and the press, you know, has you know, generally called us when they need us at this point, and you know, we're seeing lots of interesting things. I mean, Peter's being taken seriously by the high end of journalism, the highest end of journalism, and I don't want to. We've got a couple things in the works right now that are something that we never would have dreamed of a couple of years ago, and it's refreshing to see that. That he's getting taken more seriously, and I think a lot of it is this YouTube video, which you guys have helped us do. I mean, the fact that it's got so many 900,000 hits so far has really gotten on a lot of people's radar screens. NPR did a story about that video that was listened to by 15 million people, and I think that NPR story was, you know, that, you know, that all things considered is considered to be all things. So anyway. I'm running out of time here, and I want to thank you guys for listening. Thank you guys for all your support. Maybe sometime I'll be back here and hosting the show. Peter will be impressed by my performance, and he'll say, well, that's pretty good. I'm in the New York City office, a bunch of guys. If you're in the New York area and you're near 27th and Park, feel free to stop by. We'd love to say hi. And have a Merry Christmas, and keep those calls and letters coming, and keep watching Peter. He was, I should have given you a schedule, but I don't know what when it's going to be, but he's on Kudlow tonight, as you saw. Anyway, thanks a lot, and bye-bye. Don't lose faith.